Let's say that I hire a lawyer that has a contingency fee arrangement. I'm involved in a personal injury. I get hurt. I call this 800 number. You are not all from California, but if you were, you would be besieged by 800 numbers for personal injury lawyers. There's about one personal injury lawyer in California for every personal injury. And their numbers are on the television just about every hour or 2 hours. Is anybody here from California? Aren't you lucky?
So far.
But in any case, most of these lawyers work on what is called a contingency basis. What does that mean? You don't owe me anything until I get a settlement, and then I get roughly 30-35% of the settlement. Now let's talk about the incentive of a contingency lawyer. If you think about the legal process, the process begins by my charging you with a wrong. You've hurt me. I recite that in a complaint, and I present it to a court and say, you hurt me. And here's why, and here's the financial consequences of my hurt. Okay? I've hurt my arm. I can't work for 6 months, and for the next 5 years, I'm going to be only half as effective as I used to be. And therefore, that's going to cost me $400,000 in lost economic value to my life. So I sue you for negligence for $400,000. Now, we have to prove the case. This is where it gets difficult, right? Every case, we have to get evidence, because that evidence is going to be used to persuade a jury. This evidence process is also delineated in these civil procedures, but it usually involves anywhere up to 12 months of evidence gathering. Now, evidence gathering can be very expensive. If you're dealing in a lawsuit regarding a patent infringement, you might request from a drug company, or a technology company, or a software company, 100,000 pages of documents. I want to see a copy of everything in your file. There was a suit against IBM. Result was 100 million pieces of paper had to be reproduced as a result of this evidence gathering process. If it's a personal injury, I have to go and get a couple expert doctors, right? Who can verify that I've been hurt, that this is a significant hurt, and that the consequences of this hurt is that I'm not going to be able to be as economically capable as I otherwise would be. That costs money. You don't hire expert witness doctors for, you know, 15 cents and a thank you and a cup of coffee. It costs money. Now, if you are a contingency lawyer and you're trying to make a case, how much do you think you have the incentive to spend gathering evidence? How many expert doctor witnesses, how many lab tests, how many pages of documents are you going to want to spend your time and energy going through at your expense to win this case? Well, again, going back to incentives, perverse incentives, my judgment would have me believe that if I'm a contingency lawyer, I'd like to get a quick settlement and get out fast before I incur the costs of a lengthy, drawn-out, expensive evidence-gathering process. And so there's another perverse incentive working even in a contingency basis. And that is, a contingency lawyer typically likes to get in quick and get out quick, take their 30%. And even if that means a little bit less of a settlement, getting 30% of something today is worth a lot more than 30% of a little bit more tomorrow, having incurred the cost of all of this evidence gathering. So there's perverse incentives involved in all of these procedures. And what that means is, a lot of critics of the legal system have said, you know, there may be many situations where the legal process isn't the best process to resolve these types of disputes. Now, let me quickly go through the process of making laws, because We've been talking, I've been talking. You haven't done any talking at all. I'm going to stop right now. And let me ask you, do any of you have any questions or comments?
Well,
you look like you've got one.
I've seen some problems with arbitration that don't solve an awful lot of problems either.
You're absolutely right.
Go to arbitration, and then you've got to select arbiters, and they are not always knowledgeable, and there's a... Some of these claims can be very, very difficult to bring a level of knowledge to the people who are supposed to make the decision.
Absolutely.
And usually one is chosen by each side, and so they already have a bias.
Right.
And that's the third.
Right. What you're referring to is the fact that if you use arbitration to resolve a dispute, then you are limited to the expertise of, and you're limited to the selection process of an arbitrator. Now, typically in an arbitration, there are three arbitrators that are shown to both parties, and they have to select mutually one arbitrator. And none will be selected until both sides agree that that arbitrator is acceptable to them. One of the advantages of arbitration is that if you've got a dispute involving, say, a patent infringement, you probably are going to find a judge that's now retired, who's now an arbitrator, who has probably done a lot of, you know, patent infringement cases over their career. And so you have a much higher likelihood of getting a qualified arbitrator, because when you go into the legal system, you don't pick the judge. Okay? So if you want a judge, and it would be nice to have a judge with some practical experience in patent infringement, you don't necessarily get one. You probably have a better chance of getting that in arbitration. But I still agree with you. Arbitration, where you pick an individual and you say within certain frameworks, you are going to decide this dispute and we are going to live with the consequences of it, is a risky proposition. In fact, any time you've got a win-lose situation in a dispute, you win, you lose, you have a risky situation. I agree with you. Arbitration is not my favorite dispute resolution techniques. Arbitration is only a small step from a legal dispute resolution techniques, using the legal system itself. Not much different. Because in a legal process, you have a winner and a loser. In an arbitration process, you almost always have a winner and a loser. And what I'm going to be talking about Thursday is there ought to be better ways to resolve disputes than have winners and losers. There ought to be ways to try to identify solutions to disputes that don't necessarily involve winners and losers. Now, that's not always possible. I'm not naive about it. But I certainly agree arbitration is much closer to a legal resolution than it is to some of the other techniques we'll be talking about. Some of this information I found to be interesting as I pursued it. Because I love the fact that most people say there ought to be a law. I don't know how many times I've heard that. There ought to be a law. You see something happen, there ought to be a law. Well, let me tell you something. You have a Congress in this country, and you probably have a legislature in your state that has taken you up on that comment. Whenever you say, or whenever a group of you say there ought to be a law, there's some subcommittee of the Congress, or there's some committee of your state legislature that is ready to go to bat for you. And let me show you how it works, okay? And we'll talk mainly at the U.S. congressional level as opposed to the state level. I'm not from Minnesota, and I don't even understand the state of California. In fact, the state of California, they don't even pass laws. We actually, as citizens, get to vote on all of the controversial issues because the state legislature is too scared to take a position. So we have, we vote every November on all the controversial issues, and we keep it out of the legislature because they are typically too scared to vote up or down on these issues. But let me recite some numbers for you. In 1992, in Washington, D.C., there were 40,111 lobbyists registered. There's 400 and how many congressmen? 492? 100 senators? 40,111 lobbyists, of which only about 9,000 are active. So your average senator has about 400 active lobbyists pursuing him or her during the course of the year. When the Congress of the United States passes a law, or when a committee or agency of the federal government, Federal Trade Commission, Department of Housing and Urban Development, you pick it. Pick an agency that you're aware of, Department of Agriculture, I don't know what your business happens to be. Whatever it is, there's an agency representing you back there. They produce regulations. How many of you are involved in a heavily regulated activity? Health.
Yep.
What else?
Camping.
Camping?
Yes. More and more every year.
Of course, more and more. That goes without saying. But you've got the Forest Service, you've got the Department of Interior.
The Health Department.
Excuse me, I missed a whole bunch of them. Okay. Every year, all of these people produce regulations. And by law, they're supposed to publish these regulations in something called the Federal Register. Anybody ever heard of the Federal Register? Okay, that's a very big thing. Has anybody ever tried to read it? No. Parts of it, right? Okay. The Federal Register, every year, publishes a certain number of pages. And during the Reagan administration, there was a post-Carter low. Okay, you have Carter, Reagan, okay. So there was a post-Carter low during the Reagan administration. We always think of, you know, anti-regulation Reagan. Well, he got it down to 47,118 pages during the Reagan administration. That was the lowest year on record for the Federal Register. Bush, in 1991, had it back up to 67,000 pages. So Reagan got it down to 47,000, Bush got it back up to 67,000. I have no idea what's going to happen this year. I wouldn't even hazard a guess. But that is what influences your camping business, obviously health, but it influences everybody's business. Everybody is involved in some employment activity or other where the Department of Labor is promulgating regulations that affect your life. Now, you don't know about them. Typically, you're not aware of them, yet you're going to break the law and you're not even going to know it. It's going to happen because you couldn't possibly be aware of all this. Yet, this is the law of the land. These are the regulations that you're going to follow. And if you are unfortunate enough to get caught at the wrong time in the wrong place doing the wrong thing, you're going to be subject to the consequences of them. The Department of Justice is the organization that we think of as being most directly responsible for carrying out the activities of the judicial system of this country. Okay? They resolve both criminal and civil disputes of a variety of types. They also handle all the disputes that you have with all these agencies of government that regulate, okay? So if you happen to put something in a creek somewhere, cut a tree, not in, put a cover on your garbage can, whatever it is that you might do wrong, there's somebody that could come around, investigate what you've done, and sue you if they don't like what you've done. That, for the most part, if the government decides to go after you for some reason, that basically is done through a district attorney, an assistant district attorney in the various jurisdictions around the country. Okay, let me tell you about the Department of Justice. Between 1980 and 1992, the Department of Justice payroll grew from 53,000 to 98,000. It grew 4.5 times faster than federal civilian payroll as a whole. Today there are 4,200 local assistant U.S. attorneys, 2.5 times as many as 1980. Now I know in this room, many of you have said, within the last 5 years, we need more judges, we need more enforcement of the laws, because this country is out of control. Right?
Just some of the laws.
Just some. Just selectively speaking. Just the ones I'm interested in. Okay, I want you to know, however, that when you say that, your representatives have been listening. They constantly provide more money to the Department of Justice for more assistant district attorneys, more staff for the assistant district attorneys, more district attorneys, bigger federal courthouses, more federal jails. They've been listening. They've been listening. In fact, we're going to be the proud recipient down in San Diego, where I live, of getting 400 more people at the border to stop illegal aliens from penetrating the invisible wall. Now, having lived in San Diego, I know how silly that is. There's not one thing that 400 more immigration officials can do to stop people from coming from Mexico into the United States. Nothing. Yet, there's some politician somewhere saying, hey, we've solved the problem, we've responded to the need, we're going to become forceful in stopping these illegal immigration from taking place, and now there's 400 more people to add to our list of 98,000. When the United States government was born, there were three specific crimes. Okay? You know what they were? Three crimes in the beginning of our country. What do you think they were? Number one was treason. We live in a country that for the most part is patriotic, and treason is just not a big deal anymore. Okay? So we don't need 98,000 judicial people in Washington to deal with treason. What's number two? Counterfeiting. I'm going back now a couple hundred years, okay? Counterfeiting, that was number two of the three crimes that you could commit back in 1780. Okay. That only represents 2% of all the crimes that the Department of Justice deals with today. 2%. What's the third one? I have to even look. That's right, piracy. Okay. So if we go back 200 years and we say, all right, we have this Department of Justice, it's the third branch of government, we're going to give it a mission, it's going to have to deal with these problems. Okay? Piracy, number one, counterfeiting, number two, treason, number three. Now, piracy isn't a big deal anymore. Counterfeiting, 2% of our workload, and of course, treason hasn't been a big deal for some time either. So now, what is this Department of Justice all about? Well, what it's all about is that there are now 3,000 things that you can be criminally prosecuted for, okay? We've taken a list of three, we've added 2,997 more. So now you can go to jail for polluting, you can now go to jail for almost anything you can dream up. So if you've ever said there ought to be a law, you've got it. You just don't know you've got it, okay? And by the way, most other people don't know it's there either. All right. It's not until somebody really steps over the line, affects enough people, that somebody says, you know, that law is there, we just haven't bothered with it, we're now going to commit the assistant district attorneys, we're going to put enough of them on it to deal with it. You know what the number one assistant district attorney issue is right now? You know. What is it? Medical fraud. Ah, yes. Bigger than the savings and loan crisis. In the state of California today, they are They are prosecuting roughly 50 people a day on medical fraud. It's going to, I mean, we're not talking dollars. We're not talking millions. We're talking billions. Okay. So we are now looking at medical fraud of Medicare, Medicaid, workers' compensation. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. But we do it better and more in California than anywhere else. So watch us and you'll see what's coming. The point is that now they're going to turn the attention. You know, we've got the SNL crooks done. Now we're going to go after the medical fraud crooks. Point in saying all this is there's not many more laws to pass. Why is it? Yes.
Well, it seems like you said we got the SNL crooks. No, but it doesn't seem like we did anything to them, did we?
Well, you prosecuted them.
Is that got a hand? They let them go.
Well, that's what we do to all the crooks in this country.
If you have enough money.
Listen, the average murder, the average burglary, the average armed robbery in California, I can only speak for California, is never in jail more than about 3 or 4 months, if they ever go there at all. I mean,
why worry about breaking law? Might break law. You know, nothing's going to happen anyway.
Well, part of that's the point. I mean, and let me just respond to that, because that bothers me too. All right, but if I've got 3,000 laws that I'm responsible for, and I honestly believe that those laws are appropriate laws, and that we ought to enforce those laws, then I'm going to tell you something. We're all going to be in jail. Maybe not every one of us. There's a few people that live up here, you know. But most of us live in cities. We deal with employers and employees. We get in trouble. I mean, we don't always get caught. But what if we said, let's prosecute all of them? Let's go after everybody that breaks one of these 3,000 laws. I'm telling you something. There aren't enough jails, there aren't enough courts, there aren't enough police, there aren't enough to do it. So by definition, we've got to be selective. We've got to decide, are we going to put all of these assistant district attorneys on the SNL crooks, or are we going to send them on the medical fraud team, or are we going to go after the polluters, or are we going to go after those...
How about the rapists that didn't get out and then commit another crime about 4 times over, and then they...
What about them?
Yeah, that's what I think. What about them? What are we going to do with them?
You're asking me for answers.
Yeah.
I don't have the answers.
And the percentages you're giving, I mean, people should realize you're talking about federal stuff, not state law.
Oh, right. Just take what I'm giving you and multiply by
50.
Because...
So the rapes are state stuff, for the most part.
Well, no. Here's a good one, okay? I'll just read this to you. All right. Political leverage is what this is all about. That is passing laws. The 40,000 lobbyists. You want a law, there ought to be a law. Pay enough to a lobbyist, you got a law. All right. Now you've got what you want. What you don't have when you get a law is enforcement. Okay? And that's what the battle's all about. Anybody can get a law. All right. What people can't always get is enforcement of a law. Because that's where the resources come from. Let me read this to you and I'll come back to that point. Political leverage is what this is all about. Passing new laws makes Congress seem responsive to the wants and fears of the voter. Seem responsive. Stealing someone's car at gunpoint was always a serious crime in all 50 states. But after a Washington, D.C. suburban mother was killed in a savage carjacking last September, Congress made a show of getting tough on crime by making armed carjackings federal crime. Now, it was already a crime in every state. You know, you walk up to somebody and say, I want your car, and you shoot them or not, it's a crime, okay? But somebody said there ought to be a law, right? I don't know who said it. Okay. Representative Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, chairman of the House Subcommittee on Crime, and the sponsor of the carjacking bill, is proud of his work. This is why government was formed, to make people feel safe, unquote. Trouble is, They're already paying for it through the state and local law enforcement agencies. In 1991, state and local governments spent $75 billion on cops, prisons, prosecutors, courts, a sum in no way diminished by increased federal spending. There's no evidence that adding a federal layer of law enforcement decreases the number of armed carjackings. So my point in all this is simply to say we are simply expanding the breadth of all of these potential conflicts in our society, and yet we don't have the resources to enforce the laws that we've got in the books. My solution, to partial solution to your problem, is we've got to start taking some of the laws off the books and focus on those which we think are the most important. Because we can't have 3,000 equally important laws. We can't have 3,000 equally important violations because we can't enforce them. If you can't enforce them, why have them? And we have to decide how much in resources that we want to devote as a country to the enforcement mechanism. Now let me move along a little bit. Oh, cripe. What time does your watch say?
14.
All right, 5 minutes. Okay. Gee, I was just having fun. I'm going to give you a little bit of information that you can walk around with as you ponder the next few days. I went through the literature and part of this investigation because I was interested in what it costs for you and I as taxpayers to support the legal system of this country. What does this system cost? We now have 900,000 lawyers in the United States. That number is growing by 30,000 a year. We all know we have more lawyers per capita than any other country in the world. Okay. And the growth of the cost of just legal fees has been growing at a compound rate of about 9% per year. Okay. GNP grows around 5 or 6. This has been growing at about 9. We talked about what it costs for the Department of Justice. Multiply that. In every state in the United States, we're dealing with the same thing. And in every jurisdiction, what do people want? More jails, longer sentences, right? Am I right? Okay. You've been paying for them. We're getting them, okay? How many more jails can we afford? How many more sentences can we have? Now, I'm not sitting here saying that rapists should be walking the street. I don't believe that. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure people that pollute a stream for the first time ought to be in jail, though. Okay? I mean, we have to draw the line somewhere, okay?
I agree.
And, you know, if I cut a tree down out here in this wilderness, should I go to jail? I'm sure there's a law that will send me there if I do it. I'm not going to do it, but what if I do by mistake? And I get caught. Forest ranger just happens to walk by. Okay? I could go to jail because we've got a law. Now, I'm not going to say which law is right and which law is wrong. That's part of the problem. I have my own list. We all do. Okay, what does this cost this society? There was a study done in 1986 by the RAND Corporation. RAND Corporation is a private think tank located in Santa Monica. They have an Institute for Civil Justice, which does specific research in terms of the legal system. They estimated about $51 to $58 billion a year. Okay. Just in the Department of Justice and the private legal system, dispute resolution in the legal system. Tillinghast, which is a private organization dealing with legal insurance, they estimated in 1987 $117 billion. Vice President Quayle, remember him? Okay, he had a productivity council? They've actually, this administration has wiped it off and they're now bringing back all those recommendations. But he did this and he got criticized roundly for trying to attack bureaucracy and all that waste in government stuff. Well, he estimated that the cost of the legal system was $350 billion. Okay, The best study I've seen, however, is by a University of Texas professor, an economist. And what he did was, and I'll close with this, what he did was real interesting. He said, I'm going to do an econometric, that is an economic study using a bunch of variables we put in a model, and I'm going to compare growth rates of economies, and I'm going to use as one of the variables the number of lawyers per capita. Okay? And I'm going to do this across different countries. Take all the developed countries in the world, right? Britain, Germany, Japan, throw them all in there, and one of the variables will be number of lawyers per capita. Who had the most lawyers per capita? We won, okay? When he said, what does it cost to have a large number of lawyers, increased litigation, increased numbers of laws, increased costs in trying to avoid litigation, and we'll have to get into this in another session. He tried to put all that into his factors, and what he concluded is that the optimum number of lawyers per capita is 26 in a country. The two countries closest to that number are Germany and Japan. And we're at 42. Okay? And he said, what we've done is gone past what is the optimum number of lawyers per capita. And as we add from 26 on, what we get is more regulation, more litigation, more preventive cost maintenance, and all of this stuff. And it's costing this country $600 billion. You know what that is for every worker in the United States? The cost of 1 year's medical insurance, $2,500 a year. So from his perspective, he said, you know, if you look at this from a global standpoint, all of this legal dispute, legal preventive medicine is an incredibly costly thing, probably second only to medical costs. And it is influencing everybody, from running campgrounds, certainly hospitals, anybody that's involved in any of that. But I dare say, I don't see how you can work today for anybody or have anybody reporting to you without being influenced significantly by it. Now, I will close on that basis, and we better get to Vespers. Thank you.
Thank you.